Welcome. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, and this is Dying to Talk, a special four-part series on KALW dedicated to transforming the taboos surrounding death and dying. The fact that you're listening means you've already started the conversation. If the thought of having these conversations makes you a little or very uncomfortable, you're not alone. I invite you to hang in there, stay curious, and listen with an open mind. I'm a medical doctor and a scientist, and for the last decade, my work and my passion has been caring for people with life-altering and life-threatening illnesses. Today, I'm a member of the palliative care team at UCSF, and there I have the opportunity to support patients of all ages talking with their families, with their doctors, to ensure that the care that matters is the only thing delivered. My work has given me a unique vantage point to appreciate not only how devastating life and death can be in the absence of talking, but even more importantly, how inspiring and profound life can be when we do talk. During tonight's program, we'll explore the challenges and graces of caregiving, both as provider and as recipient. The fact is, each of us have, or will have, the experience of being cared for or helping to provide care to someone, perhaps even at the same time. You may be in the sandwich generation, someone who is a caregiver to both your own aging parents while continuing to raise young children. The demands of either of these roles can easily strain your relationship with friends or family members, as well as your ability to be productive at work inside as well as outside the home. You add these two things together and begin to believe only superhumans are up to the task. If this sounds familiar, you are not alone. In fact, recent studies estimate over 40 million people in the U.S. are currently providing unpaid caregiving services, with about 1 in 3 doing it completely solo. How are you doing this? These studies suggest many of you sacrifice who you are and what you love in order to care for the people you love. Well, tonight's program is not about studies. It's about stories. We're going to begin with one person's story, in the hopes that hers will resonate with your own and that you'll share your thoughts, your questions, and your experiences with all of us. So perhaps by the end of the hour, our voices will, like the patches of a quilt, form a new tapestry that can begin to embrace the growing experiences and needs of caregiving. I've had the honor of working with Avtar Kaur Khalsa over the past several years, and she'll correct me as we get into the conversation that it's been longer than I think, as she's experienced the role of caregiving in 3 very different settings. She exemplifies a new generation of caregiving I now call the club sandwich generation, when caregiving roles supporting both parents and grandparents overlap. Avtar, welcome to Dying to Talk.
Thank you so much, Dawn.
So as I just mentioned, you and I have been working together in supporting your role as caregiver for your parents and now your grandmother for what I originally thought was just a couple years, but you corrected me.
Yeah, I think it goes back 5 years now.
So tell me how that occurs for you. When did we first start talking about this?
Well, I think I started to share some concerns about my mom, whether she was really able to live independently, and I remember you're saying, well, eventually you're going to have to step in or something, or, you know, she won't be able to do it, or you won't be able to let her be on her own. And I remember thinking, yes, I can.
So the fact that you were actually imagining and speaking out loud about this, and we started a conversation, has now had you reflect on when caregiving really begins and that there are perhaps different phases. I think when I relate to how I first formally began supporting you and initially your supporting your mom was a couple of years ago. And what happened then?
Well, I, you know, my mom was very autonomous. She always encouraged me to be very autonomous. I always felt like I was the recipient of her love and care and support. I felt like she was this very vital force of nature. And she was driving around and she was doing exactly what she wanted in retirement, which was taking big pieces of fabric and cutting it into little pieces of fabric and sewing them into patchwork quilts. And I lived far away.
Across the country.
3,000 miles away, about as far as you can get on the continent. And I talked to her every once in a while. It went fine. I'd visit every once in a while. And at some point, I went home and I just saw that things were not really working out.
So what did you notice from, tell us first how you remember her and then what you came to see when you went to visit her.
Well, I remember her as, I used to call her a one-person volunteer social service agency. She could talk to anybody. She would listen, empathize. She would see something in people, and she would really support that. She would go out of her way to help them. She would drive them to meetings. She loved to drive to her quilt guild. She'd pick up her friends and drive them there. One of her friends talked about getting a ride with her to a workshop from Long Island, where she lived, up to Westchester County. You know, it's a bit of a drive. And then my mother dropped her off. She got in the car with her ever-present mug of tea, bombed off to this workshop, and then she said, okay, I'll pick you up later. And she's like, wait a second, you gave me a ride and you're not even attending this workshop? It's like, no, I have something else to do in the city. I'll be back. And she just had a lot of projects. She took care of a lot of other friends of hers. She saw them through the end of their lives. She made those, you know, experienced those difficult transitions. And over the years, she began to be, she'd read the same novels over and over again. She'd say, well, I can't remember which ones I read. And I'd say, oh, yeah, I have that feeling too. But then I started to realize she really didn't remember what she was reading. She had difficulty finishing projects. She'd come to my house and we'd design quilts. And that was okay with me. I had no need for her to perform in any way. But it gradually began to dawn on me that she couldn't really contain her life. She was always a talker. I think I inherited some of that from her, like maybe a lot. You know, she was the kind of person you'd have to get off the phone with her. She would never be the first one to ring off. And it started to, stopped being able to pick up the thread. Mm. She would be pleasant, she'd be happy, she would talk, but then she'd be done.
And that was really different.
It was really different. It was really different. Sometimes she'd say, maybe I'm lonely, or even her friends would start to express their concern to me. I'm like, oh, she's fine, you know. And at some point, it was like this sea change, you know, where I was in this sea of her love and support and ability, and I was just kind of I was immersed in that. I took it for granted, and suddenly I just realized this has to go the other way.
Tide.
Not only is she not able to be there for me now, but I have to show up for her in a big way, for which I am woefully unprepared. Mm.
What were those things that felt overwhelming, where you say you were woefully unprepared? What? Because you're a mom. One might say that how is one prepared for that, and yet somehow, as a mom, you're prepared.
That sort of happened then, too.
It sort of But here, you really had this, I am woefully unprepared. So what do you recall stepping into going, oh, my gosh, where do I begin?
Well, she was always a kind of a collector. She reveled in all this fabric in her house. She had the fortune cookie that said you'll spend your old age in material wealth. But I saw that things were getting really impassable. She was less and less able to take care of her body, of her house. I was concerned about her bombing off in the car everywhere. And and I was concerned that she didn't know. This was a big mistake I think I made, that she didn't get it, that I had to really lobby and convince her about her disability, that her memory was going and her ability to be independent was going. And she really tried to shield that and deny that. And eventually one time we're going to the doctor and I said something. I realized I didn't want to spring onto her that, you know, maybe I was going to get the doctor to take the car away from her. And she said, wait, look. I'm going to this appointment. I really need to be a human being. And I realized she knows. She absolutely knows. Mm. And I can stop lobbying. Mm.
So what were some of the things then with that realization, that revelation, that then started to take place for you as from daughter care receiver to caregiver?
Well, I started wondering, can she stay in her home? Mm. It's kind of like you had said, well, at some point you're going to have to intervene, and you see this a lot. Well, eventually we couldn't have her. And she had raised me, given me so much autonomy. She respected my decision so much that I really wanted to be that for her. And I wanted to find people in her life that could, that she would feel comfortable caring for her, ways that she could do what she wanted, but maybe not be driving so much, or maybe having some people to help her. And she really resisted. She was very happy. She loved seeing me and my brothers, and she would just sit there very happy in her chair. And if we would start cleaning up or trying to take care of stuff, she'd be like, what are you doing?
And so then how did you eventually negotiate, or was it not?
Well, it was really hard. And eventually she started to alarm her medical caregivers. And they would be contacting me and saying, she can't be alone. You have to, you know, it's kind of like you have to do something. And I'm like, yeah, help me out here. And it was kind of like, they didn't have much to offer me. They really, somehow in terms of specifics of where to go, whom to call, how to negotiate, how to hold somebody. At one point, I was there with my brother, and the doctor was talking about her three children. She said, well, you three have to decide what to do. And I said to her, to the doctor, the four of us, you know, including my mom. And my mom said, well, thank you. But I just feel like so few of us are equipped to really face this. It was hard for her to face. It was hard for me to face. And I was really grateful for your support and guidance. I think I really did wait. I figured something's going to happen. Mm. You know what I thought of as a triggering event?
Mm-hmm.
And one day my brother took her to the doctor, and the doctor sent her straight to the emergency room. Mm. That was a triggering event.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And prior to that, I mean, she did, as I recall, have friends checking in and friends reaching out to you, as you said, saying, I think something's up. And now you had some of her healthcare providers echoing that, but without a roadmap, without a clear next step until this triggering event, as you said, where she's suddenly, somewhat unexpectedly, sent to the emergency room. And what happened next?
Well, they admitted her into the hospital with congestive heart failure. They put her in a room with leads all over her chest, you know, to electronically monitor her. There were doctors coming in and checking those leads and taking her blood pressure and, you know, moving her around and making sure they had access to the equipment, trying to talk to her, asking her a lot of questions that were very hard for her to answer. They'd ask questions that weren't really questions, like, can I take your blood pressure? And she'd be like, can I get your arm? She'd be like, no.
So, I mean, did you have a sense that she knew what was happening and why she was there? And
not really. I think she knew she was there and she really did not want to be there. Yeah. And she knew she was really uncomfortable. and that people were poking and prodding and they were hurting her shoulder and her foot. You know, she had like a hangnail but in her toe that was really, really painful. So she would be sort of yelling and they didn't want her to, you know, they didn't, things that she wanted to do, like get up and go to the bathroom, they didn't want her to do. And things that she didn't want to do, they did want her to do.
So how did you begin to negotiate those things with her as well as with the medical team around her?
Well, just by being there, hanging out.
So you literally flew out, first of all.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And my brothers and I just kind of camped out. Mm. And we did our best to ambush the doctor on his rounds, you know, or wait, you know, try to be there at the times, the early, early morning times when he would zip through. And at one point, she was disoriented. Mm-hmm. She didn't like it. She was uncomfortable. She didn't like having these people in her space, and she let them know. Mm-hmm. And that got in the way of the care that they wanted to give and sort of the well-oiled machine that's mm-hmm. the hospital. Mm-hmm. And at one point, they wanted to take her blood pressure or something, and she just started flailing around. You know, mm. those questions where they weren't taking no for an answer. Mm. And she kind of started flailing around, and suddenly there was about 800 pounds of nurse flesh coming into the door of the room with a straitjacket.
Wow.
And I was like, whoa, do we? And this was because of the schedule, right? They couldn't really wait until she was in a better frame of mind. I said, do we have to do this? Do we have to do this now? And they kind of, this team just sort of rocked back on their heels, started looking at their clipboards, leafing through the clipboard, and it's like, actually, no.
It's such an important moment of realization for everyone, what you did just then. I think now you can probably reflect, given other things that you have worked through with other family members, that what you were doing in that moment was refocusing people's attention on who are we here to serve and in what is our goal.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like up until that point, your mom hadn't actually been complaining of anything, per se, that people were tending to in the hospital that other people were concerned about. And this was this moment of, what are we trying to accomplish here? Who are we trying to ease, and what are we trying to ease? And that was
a
real
turning
point.
What's effective? What is effective care, you know?
So the caregiving that you were providing, even though she's in the hospital, it's not you providing what we often think of in the home as hands-on caregiving, helping to feed someone, clothe someone, bathe someone. What you were doing in that moment was advocating for the type of care that others were physically able to provide, or maybe she didn't want provided for her. And so how ultimately that evolved in more specific ways as far as what care was going to become possible and in what settings, what do you remember about these different transitions then that came about, and how, what role you played in how they evolved?
Hmm. And you played. I became kind of overwhelmed with the idea of bringing her home and taking care of her at her home.
But she was asking for that, as I recall.
She wanted to go home. She wanted to go home. She didn't want to go. She didn't want to be admitted. She didn't want to stay. She didn't want any of that. And I felt like, well, we have to send her to a nursing home. Because I saw the nurses moving her around. You know, it took two or three of them. And I thought, how are we going to do this? Mm. So she went to rehab.
Mm-hmm.
And she, you know, it was like the very best I just tried. Again, with my sort of unqualified, two steps behind kind of feeling, try to find the best place for her. Mm. and, you know, found a really wonderful, highly recommended place, very opulently beautiful, at least in the lobby. And she went there for rehab, really dedicated caregivers, talking to them. She had physical therapy. She couldn't get very far down the hall. But she found the back door to get out of that place. Mm. And she got out the back door twice. And when I would come to visit, she'd be like, "Oh, am I glad to see you.
Get me out of
here. What are we doing here? Why are we here?" And sometimes I brought her like mending to do. She was really expert seamstress. Mm. And I'd bring her like, bring my brother's pants to hem or something. And I just see this sense memory take over. Mm. She could just do that. She was very competent. It was very instinctive. She knew she was doing something purposeful, and it was just a moment of contentment.
Right. And so what you did was, in this environment where she's being surrounded by, again, very loving, caring, attentive professionals, but they're having her do things very unfamiliar to her. And while they're in the best interest, they're really outside of her comfort zone. And what you did was bring in something extremely intimately familiar to her. Not that pants necessarily needed mending by her, but in this act, it was like, this is a reminder, this is who you are. You did something else, I recall, advocating strongly for.
She always had a cup of tea, a pot of tea, a cup of tea, even in the most unlikely, like I said, while driving, you know, you'd think it wouldn't be worth it or really work. And so, you know, I tried to tell these people that were trying to get her to do stuff or to talk to her that everything is going to go better with a cup of hot tea, not a styrofoam cup. It has to be a ceramic cup. And it doesn't have to be any kind of special tea, but it should be there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people really took it to heart. Some people didn't quite get it. But this was what was really important to her. This is what made her, this was her kind of blankie, you know, was her cup of tea.
And again, reminding her she's still herself, even if all these other things around her are unfamiliar, or even what's happening to her body is unfamiliar. She is still there, and you recognizing what those things are and bringing them to her and sharing with her healthcare team what's possible to help her remember who she is just at the core of caregiving. And so I want us to come back and talk about what you learned as recognizing that, bringing that to your mom, and how that's shown up in other places in life. I want to remind our listeners that this is Dying to Talk. And tonight's episode, we're focusing on the special attention that's required for caregivers providing care, as well as people who are receiving care when that can be unfamiliar. I hope you'll continue to join us after this break.
You're listening to Dying to Talk on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. And if you'd like to join the conversation on Dying to Talk, the phone lines are open at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email Dawn Gross at dawn@dyingtotalkradio.com. And you can find resources related to this conversation at kalw.org.
Welcome back to Dying to Talk. We are dying to talk with you about caregiving and what your experiences are or have been as either a recipient of care, as someone who's been providing care. And some of you know this at the same time, there are people who are forced into a position of needing to care for someone while they themselves need care. And if you're out there listening, we really want to hear your story. We want to answer your questions. As you've been hearing from my guest, Avtar, that there are really no signposts and there are a few guides to help us know when these epiphanal moments arrive in our life until they're really sudden, perhaps. And in the case of your mother, as we were just talking about, Avtar, you know, she suddenly was brought to the hospital, not because she necessarily even saw it coming, but something happened. Her doctor saw something, and next thing you know, she's in the hospital. Completely unfamiliar territory for her, as well as your family. Eventually transitioned to a skilled nursing facility to try and rehabilitate her body. Still very unfamiliar. She's backed out twice, as you said, literally found the back door looking for ways to get home. You brought her the physical comforts of not only home, but also her identity to as much extent as you could in that environment. And ultimately, it still wasn't enough. What happened then?
Well, it really wasn't working for her. And we just endeavored to get her home, to get caregivers that could live in with her, that could stay with her, and to really realize that that really was possible. That she, you know, her company, her joy, one of her joys was just to be in her own environment and to be with her cat.
Right.
And I remember asking if her, I knew that probably a cat couldn't come into a medical facility, but the staff just laughed at me. It's kind of like, and so we were able to arrange for her to come home, or at least we took that leap.
And it was a leap. I think for many people, that will resonate, that there is this leap of being in a medical environment where it feels like everyone knows what to do and we're doing everything in the best interest of
and
those we're
safe
serving.
And she's clean and she's fed.
And yet, she wasn't happy.
No, it wasn't like really worth
being safe.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that was this leap. And I distinctly remember talking with you for a while about how do we do this and how will we know it will be okay?
And just the idea that there are people out there, there's competent care, experienced, caring, skillful caregivers that can deal with this.
At home.
At home.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really dedicated, and maybe not the mini-me, but better than me in a lot of ways. Willing, dedicated, able, and available. And after her escapades of leaving the facility, she got kind of pushed back into the locked memory unit. And determined to get her home, and scheduled that, and I remember the social worker saying, you know, I've never discharged anybody from this floor. You know, this, people just don't, doesn't go this way from here. So, and it was really, really wonderful, just that moment when she got home. She wasn't so responsive or animated, but the cat came to sit by her. And she reached out for that cat, and she sat in her chair, and she was home.
Yeah. There's something...
with her tea and her cat.
Something beyond medicine in that moment, right? And really priceless. We actually have a question here for you, Avtar, from the studio audience, asking, why did you choose to bring your mom home rather than, say, an assisted living facility? And is there a cost that you explored where assisted living is more expensive as compared to home? Now, you weren't the one physically ultimately caring for her at home because you were 3,000 miles away.
So I was just dropping in.
So there was still expense related to her coming home.
I really wanted her not to be in that. I didn't want her to be in an institution. Mm-hmm. I wanted her to be in her home. And I found that for a similar cost, actually, it was less to hire a caregiver to be with her living in, it was much more reasonable in every way. And I just maybe it's a little bit of a cynical attitude, but I kind of felt like you know, she could be cared for or neglected at home cheaper.
Wow. She, in that setting, though, is surrounded by what's familiar, and her cat being one of the most familiar things to her, as I recall you really saying that this cat instantly crawling into her lap and just situating.
And when she wasn't talking to anybody else, she was talking to the cat. She had, again, that sort of sense response to petting the cat and the cat, you know, being there for her.
And so it's been a while now. Maybe it doesn't feel that way, but in literal time, it's been a couple years since all this happened, and she ultimately died in her home, in her bed. And I wonder how you and perhaps your family related, if you can think back to the stress of you going back and forth so much, of being on the phone so much, since you weren't living right there in her home or even in her state. And how did you maintain yourself? And I'm using that as a lead into another question we have. We have an email here that's reflecting on burnout and how caregivers don't burn out. And I'll get to that email in a second. But I wanted to first start with you. If you can think now, what do you remember the stress that was occurring at the time, and what were some things that you did to try and ease that?
Well, I, I practice yoga. I have my daily practice. So I kept that up. I felt like it's not like in the moment it would be like, oh, excuse me, I'm going to do some yoga. But it gave me kind of a nervous system to be willing to swing at the next pitch, next punch, whatever it's going to be. And to just kind of, I began to affirm that there was a way for her, that there's a way through this, and that she can be, against possibly all evidence or experience or a typical course, that there was a way for her to make it through this passage of her life. And really, that is what's happening, what happened. It wasn't easy for her. But it wasn't easy for me. But somehow making that big effort to get her home, really, it's like my brothers and I did everything to make that possible. And it gave us a tremendous sense of completion at the end of her life, that we really did what she wanted and what we wanted. And it somehow tied together a lot of the loose ends.
So even the energy, the exhaustion, the uncertainty that went with this, leap, trusting new caregivers, people you've never known, into her home, all, again, unfamiliar, but at least now she was located in a place that was familiar, she identified with. That sense of we're doing what is consistent with what makes her happy, makes her who she is, ultimately
gives
sustained
it her life.
You.
Whatever's left of her life is her life.
Yeah.
Even if it's not, you know.
Yeah. And so in respect to the email that we received from a physician, Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter here in San Francisco, and she asks that as young physicians, she's seen many of her colleagues experiencing professional burnout. We're caregivers caring for people in very difficult times in their lives. And she's asking what advice we might have for doctors on avoiding burnout as caregivers, and especially for those in the field that I practice of palliative care. And what I'm hearing from you is by focusing on supporting people in achieving what they wish, right, that you get this sense of joy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that is enough to sustain you.
Yes.
As well as community, your
family.
I'm
saying this on a good day, right? There's been a lot of tough days, yeah.
For sure. No, for sure. You didn't do this alone, I think, is the
Absolutely.
Other thing.
Absolutely.
that you do this with family in your case as well as community and friends. So I want to invite our listeners to please come join us in this conversation, that if you've been in this situation you're hearing Avtar describe and you said, gosh, if only I had known X, if only I had gotten support earlier, what is it that you know now? Please join us and share your experience. You can call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email me at dawn@dyingtotalkradio.com. That's dawn, like the sunrise, at dyingtotalkradio.com. Or post on Facebook at Dying to Talk Radio, or tweet us at Dying to Talk FM.
So, or if you ever wanted to have a doctor right on the phone to answer your questions about these kind of things.
Because that's kind of what happens. So as we think about...
Who do you call?
Who do you call? You, moving on, say, to your father, which really happened without much of a pause between supporting your mom and her eventually dying in her home with the support of caregivers that you hired as well as hospice in her home. Your father then became quite ill, but in a very different way. And in that moment, you did pick up the phone and you called.
Yes, I did.
So you had a certain experience now, certain perspective in supporting your mom and making a leap of faith, if you will, once. How is it different now?
And being able to say a little bit, do we have to do this? Do we have to do this now?
Definitely.
And yeah.
So what happened with your dad, and how was it different for you and your family as this event rolled around?
I think I had a little more experience. I think we made some of the same. You know, I waited again for a triggering event because he also didn't want help. And he also ended up going to the hospital and going to rehab and not liking it at all. And instead of waiting for him to adjust to their schedule, to their routines, as they assured me he would, it's like, well, why should he have to do that? Mm. Can we get him home? And once again, to get some caregivers.
Can we adjust to him instead of him adjusting to us?
Yeah. Listen to what... you know, can he, have his flashlight and his penknife and his, you know, the things that he always, the things that he always carried with him, and go to lunch at the same bar and grill where he ate every single day. You know, I just really moved heaven and earth to make that happen, even when it was in a wheelchair and wheeling in the back, and just try to. To give him what made him feel, what was made him feel like himself.
Himself, yeah. We have a call here from Roy in El Cerrito. Roy, welcome to Dying to Talk.
So, I'm a long-distance caregiver right now, supporting my mom, and before that, supporting my dad, who are both in New York. I'm in the Bay Area in El Cerrito. And I found a resource that I wanted to tell you about.
Oh, thank you.
It's with a Jewish Family and Community Services of the East Bay, and it's a long-distance caregiver support group. We meet twice a month, the first and third Wednesday, in the Berkeley office. And there's a facilitator, and the people who are dealing with their family issues talk, and they have expertise. And you go there, and you just feel better for the ability to get it out and get resources for you.
Roy, I mean, I'm hearing two things. Thank you for sharing this, first of all. I'm curious how you discovered it and what makes it feel safe and inviting to be able to share with total strangers what you're experiencing. Oh, we've lost Roy. I'm sorry, Roy. Maybe you'll call back because I'm very curious. But thank you so much for sharing this. I hope.
Sounds like a wonderful resource.
Because you yourself, Avtar, was a long distance
caregiver. I was a long distance caregiver to New York from the Bay Area. And I felt, you know, I felt like I'm an educated person, a smart person, a caring person. And I felt so much like I was so reaching for resources that I could not find. Mm. And so that sounds wonderful to have, just to have other people experiencing the same thing. And
I think we have Roy back. Roy, are you with us?
Hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks so much.
The robot hung up on me, but I'm glad you invited me to call back.
Well, thank you.
You had a question, and I'd be glad to answer.
I had asked a couple questions, actually, Roy. One was just how you discovered this opportunity to meet with people so specific to people providing long-distance care, and also what have you found has made it such an inviting and safe space to be and share?
Great. Good questions. I'm not sure. Frankly, I don't remember how I heard about it. But it's a unique resource of the Jewish and Family Community Service.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to be Jewish, but you don't have to be Jewish to it.
Mm-hmm.
There are people of all faiths and all ethnicities
mm-hmm.
that all have this tension in dealing with someone who's sick or far away. And the facilitator, Sherry Hart, talks about precipitating, you wait for a precipitating event,
mm-hmm.
and then you can do it. Mm. And my father was, I went there first when my father had Huntington's disease, and I really exactly didn't know how to help him well. And they talked about getting a geriatric health, geriatric specialist who could help. And I implemented that, and then there were questions of, my brother is in New York, and he's hands-on, but I wasn't exactly sure if he was making the right decisions.
Mm.
Then when I would go back, I'd have a group to talk about. I mean, when I was kind of working at it and preparing, there were about a group maybe had five to eight people would come.
Wow.
And it was a great resource, and I thought that must be, I mean, I actually looked up long-distance caregivers work group in the San Francisco office, and I think it's a pretty unique thing.
We're
open to anyone.
Roy, thank you. And I'm going to make sure we post that on the KALW Dying to Talk website so others can find it. I really appreciate you bringing that to our attention. We have a couple of other callers asking about finances. Marcia in Alameda, welcome to Dying to Talk.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, I just went through almost the identical situation. It took 7 years, and the emergency room, the rehab, etc. I would say that the one thing that I thought was really good was trying to keep some little thread of their previous life, like the tea in the teacup, and that mm-hmm. kind can be... Something that small can be more important than a lot of bigger things.
Exactly. Mm.
And in my mother's situation, the bigger thing was insisting on keeping her house, which had fallen into disrepair. And unfortunately, we did not have the finances that apparently you had, where you could hire somebody to stay, which is quite expensive when they're staying overnight. And mm-hmm. There are regulations on how many hours they can work, what the minimum wage is, et cetera,
right.
et cetera. And I was just really traumatized by the entire thing.
Mm.
I think that one of the important things is at some certain age, like certainly at that very latest, 85, if the social workers in the state or something came in and said, okay, what is the life plan now here for this person? Because in the end, a lot of these people end up having to go on Medicaid,
right.
spend down all their funds, and I felt so bad for my mother where, she was on a DNR, but they resuscitated her twice anyway.
Oh, wow.
And so she really lived 2 years too long. It was really hard because you can only try to there's nothing you can do to make somebody happy in that kind of a situation. I don't know what to do when the finances are not there to provide for, $4,000 or $5,000 or $6,000 or $7,000 a month.
It's a huge issue, isn't it? Yeah. And that's the kind of thing where I just felt like I was groping around for resources. And, yeah, why isn't there a social worker that can come in and give you plans or alternatives or anything viable?
Because sometimes they say, it's your own life. But at the right. end of life like that, it does become more of a state interest, unless the person can show they have, total finances or something. But in my mother's situation and in many people's situation, it's obvious that the finances are not going to match up. And there's...
Yes.
If we could have... The optimal for my mother is if she would have allowed us to move her into a smaller place, we could have gone through all of these treasures from her lifetime of traveling and cherry-picked just the perfect ones, like you said, these little things that keep the thread of their life. That
yeah.
would have been just perfect, but we couldn't get her to do it, and I knew
right.
I couldn't have her declared incompetent because she would have fooled anybody.
Yeah. Right. That all sounds very familiar to me.
I think, Marcia, again, you're pointing to one of these challenges that healthcare is really facing, this gap between what we call long-term care and how are we going to help support people financially as well as medically in the life that means something to them when healthcare right now isn't designed to do it. So talk to your congressperson and share these stories would be my first recommendation. Carol is another caller from Sunnyvale asking about negotiations. Carol, welcome to Dying to Talk.
Yes. Oh, thank you so much. I'm exactly in the first situation, and it is with my sister, and I do not want her children to declare her incompetent, which they seem to be absolutely set on doing. To me, a keystone with working with anyone, I've done lots of hospice situations, a keystone is always treating them with respect and attempting to negotiate in concert with who and what they are. So I am attempting to keep her in the home. And my question is twofold. How do you know when the children have had her license removed, how do you know when that is the correct thing? I mean, in other words, now she can't drive herself to the grocery store, which is damn stupid, since she always took back roads and she's not that far yet. But when do you know it is that far, and how do you find people to do the live-in? How many people does it take, and what approximately would be the cost, and how do you negotiate with them to agree to have the live-in?
Great
questions. I'm attempting to do all of those.
Yeah. And, I don't know if I can speak specifically to your situation, but I kind of faced all of those things.
I'm sure you did.
And, we had some victories and some defeats. I did find my mother, despite all of her, resistance, at one point I just sat her down with my brother and I just said in a very heartfelt way, look, we're concerned about this. Your other son is concerned about this. We gave some specifics, and we are just asking, we didn't demand, we didn't force, but we're really asking if you would accept this help. And she looked at me and she said, yes, I could do that. And I found that there is a whole pool of caregivers out there. In addition to through agencies or official channels, there are a lot of dedicated, experienced people. And that I was able to find them kind of through word of mouth, through other people, and that in both my mom's and dad's case, these weren't like specifically round the clock. They lived in. And so we'd get a couple of people that would each do 3 or 4 days, and they were able to stay. And as I say, it wasn't more expensive than institutional care. I think it's really, I get that you have to negotiate with her kids also. And I think, like you said, respect all around is really important, and helping them to realize that there's other options. I'm sure they're alarmed about their mother.
Yes, but they're trying to do it in a
they're trying
completely
to force things.
Dispowering way, which I find difficult.
I think one of the keys is the word that you chose originally, Carol, in negotiating. And And that means sometimes for us as well, as uncomfortable as that is, as maybe as unpleasant a thing to hear. And one of the things I want to close with actually is in respect to driving, which is one of the hardest things that mm-hmm. many of us anticipate facing. Avtar, because of your experience with your mom, who loved to drive, it sounds like mm-hmm. not so different yeah. from Carol's family, that you have actually made a statement.
I thought about when I get to be 80 or 85, just give a cutoff before I think I can't drive anymore. How can I deal with that to prevent my daughter from having to take the keys away from me?
Right. So in leading into a gift, in actually caring for your daughter in the anticipation that she someday will be caring for you, what can I do now, given what I've learned, to ease those burdens I can already anticipate? And there's no perfect way, but I was just so moved by that, that gift of giving forward and creating a legacy for your children. And with that, I really want to honor and thank you, Avtar, for being here with me tonight, for allowing me to support you in caring for your mom, your father, and we didn't even get a chance to talk about your grandmother, who you are currently still supporting. It is just such a gift. I learn from you all the time that you sustain me in the practice of caring for ourselves, both wholly inside and out. And it's just an honor to support you and your family in caring so lovingly the way that you do. So thank you for being.
Thank you so much, Dawn.
I want to thank everyone who called or emailed us tonight. It's your stories that help to illuminate in this bi-directional nature of caregiving, how in one moment, whether you're in the formal role of receiving or providing care, that by cultivating empathy, by being present to love, by trying to imagine being in the other person's shoes, we're always capable of giving and receiving care simultaneously. Dying to Talk is produced at the studios of KALW here in San Francisco. Rosalie Atkinson is the in-studio producer, and Joanne Marr is at the controls. Matt Martin is the advising producer, and Ashley Ann Krigbaum created the promos. All of the music for Dying to Talk is by the Oakland-based band The Kilbanes. Our next episode of Dying to Talk will be at this same time on Thursday, April 14th, when we'll be talking about advanced care planning, the who, what, where, when, why, and how to have the conversation. We're going to be having what I call a kitchen table conversation right here in studio for the entire family, so please join us. To see a full listing of programs in the series and to find resources related to tonight's program, including the addition of the Jewish Family Services resource we heard about from Roy, please visit kalw.org. And if you'd like to share this program with your family and friends, it will be available for online listening in the next hour. And before we go, I need to wish my youngest son, Kalel, a happy birthday. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, inviting you to be curious, ask questions, and never settle. Or, as a hospice patient once taught me, life is uncertain. Better eat dessert first. Ready for some birthday cake?
Turn the key, put the car in drive. No one else in the world tonight. Don't know where you're going. Road ahead is a checkered line. In a new light, star.